Good evening, everyone. Welcome to History of the Talmud, Part 16. We are about to start, I think, one of the more interesting areas of Jewish history, something which you may have learned. A lot of the stuff we've been doing until now were kind of the way things were developing inside the Beit Midrash, and not necessarily something that you would find inside of a history book. But a lot of what we're going to do now are things that if you picked up, you know, Graizel's History of the Jews, maybe the later versions, or some other book of history, you might find a lot of the information. What I try to do here is give you the Talmudic sources which confirm or highlight or complement the information that you might find in those books. So in the process, I'll give you some of the background to the story of what's going on here. So last time we spoke about the lead-up to the Bar Kokhba revolt. What was it that was the instigator to the Jewish people? And we spoke about two decrees in particular, which really got their goat, so to speak. Decree number one was the fact that they outlawed circumcision. Hadrian had his own reasons probably for outlawing circumcision, relating to this plague of castration which had taken over the Roman Empire, related to his desire to put the stamp of Roman culture upon the entirety of the Roman Empire. And so from that perspective, circumcision was just one more casualty in the attempt to apply those rules here. That's number one. Number two that was the instigator was the turning over of Jerusalem. We saw a number of Mishnayot which discuss the plowing over Jerusalem as one of the major horrific events of Tisha B'Av, and one which the Jewish people viewed as a direct blow not only to their sovereignty, but to very much their religious personality, their national personality, what it was that defined themselves. And so that became another instigator, and what makes it an instigator is now all of a sudden the revolutionaries who are having trouble finding recruits to get them to revolt, all of a sudden have a much easier time because there are a lot of angrier people out there. So what do they do? What makes the Bar Kokhba revolt successful where so many other revolts failed? So we'll start here with an interesting Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nun Zayin Amud Aleph. The Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nun Zayin Amud Aleph, is a Gemara we've seen before because that's the Gemara about Kamta and Bar Kamta. It's the set of Gemaras which one is permitted to learn on Tisha B'Av, even though there's a general prohibition of Talmud Torah. So here, among the stories that go on there of Kamta and Bar Kamta, we'll do another one of the fall of Beitar, which is the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt. But among the stories is the story of how Tormalka was destroyed. Tormalka is a city, unclear where it was. So it says as follows, as a result of an incident involving a rooster and a hen, Tormalka was destroyed. So what was the event? So they had a custom there that when they took a groom and a bride out for their wedding, they would bring a rooster and a hen out in front of them as if to say, be fruitful and multiply like hens. And one could imagine the rooster and the hen had a certain symbolic value, a sentimental value. When the family would finally form, they would adopt the rooster and the hen, and that would become the basis for their eggs that they had, the chickens that they would raise. This was something significant for them. One day, a band of Romans was passing by, and they took a rooster and hen from them. The people fell upon the Romans and smote them. The Romans reported to the emperor, the Jews have rebelled against you. The emperor came upon the Jews in battle. And it's an interesting story. So a number of things you discover here. Number one is it was not considered beyond the scope of a Roman garrison that was stationed in the land of Israel to, if there was a wedding going on, they would go and they would partake of the food as well. They wouldn't necessarily, you know, get involved. It wasn't like later in Poland where they would take the wives of, before the wedding in order to sleep with them. It wasn't that bad, but they would, you know, intrude upon what would be a very personal and familial celebration. The reason there was garrison there is because Hadrian understood, as did most Roman leaders, that if you're going to run an empire, you have to expect that there will be small revolts and revolutions along the way. Uprisings, we'll call them, not necessarily major revolutions. Little did they know that the Jewish people had been planning since their inception to overthrow the Romans, right? It goes all the way back to when Yaakov grabbed onto the ankle of Esav, that they never trusted the Romans, and they had their sights on overthrowing the Romans. So what they did was brilliant. They were getting together their groups of soldiers. Not only that, but they made the Romans think that they were their supporters. How'd they do that? They would make weapons for the Romans, but they made the weapons incorrectly. You know, they weren't exactly good. So the Romans would return them back to the Jews and say, these aren't good weapons. So where did they go? They went into the Jewish arsenal, preparing them for war. Why didn't the Romans ever question why the Jews were making bad weapons? Because Jews were never good with tools, right? So they expected not to get the best weapons from the Jews. I don't know if that's true. All right. So meanwhile, they're building up an arsenal and an army. And the Romans are unsuspecting. And all they have is their normative garrison that's there, that's led by an individual by the name of Turnus Rufus in the Gemara. And all of a sudden, the responses of the Jews to the intrusions of these Roman garrisons become much, much harsher. So harsh that they're actually defeating Roman garrisons. Roman garrisons which were not prepared for an all-out revolt. They were prepared for small uprisings, you know, maybe a few protests. They were not prepared with what went on, with this type of delinquency. And all of a sudden, the Jews find themselves having a major amount of early success. To the point, and this is the big point, is that Turnus Rufus and his entire, and all of his troops, retreat from the city of Jerusalem. So one of the first and earliest victories of Bar Kokhba and his men was that they defeated Turnus Rufus's army. Which is why, when we discover all these coins, right, which there were all over the area of Jerusalem, they were bold coins. They didn't just say, you know, the first year of the revolution, they said the first year of the redemption, right? There was an immense amount of hope. That was Bar Kokhba's hold, because the assumption was that they were doing very, very well. What was the character of this rebellion? The character of this rebellion was it was guerrilla warfare 100%. The goal of Bar Kokhba was never, ever to have to meet Roman troops on the field of battle. Small garrisons drag them into the advantage that the Jewish people had, knowing the terrain very well of the Judean hills. We all know, if we've ever taken a walk in Jerusalem, that a hill is not like, you know, kind of an incline. A hill, you feel like you're mountain climbing. And that's with the paved roads, but imagine before the paved roads what it was like to move about there. So they were hiding in the caves, they were sneaking up on the Roman garrisons. They had an immense amount of success in their first 2 years. So who was Bar Kokhba? So there are two major rabbinic sources which tell us a lot about Bar Kokhba. Interestingly enough, there's very little about Bar Kokhba in the Babylonian Talmud. Most of the information we find is from sources in Jerusalem, in the Midrashim, and in the Talmud Yerushalmi, particularly in the fourth parak of Tainith, which we're going to do a lot from there next week also. So the first is the Midrash Eicha Rabbah. In the second parak, it tells the following stories. There were two brothers in Kfar Charuba who would kill any Roman who tried to pass there. Okay, so Mistama, we can assume that who were these people? Or they were members of Bar Kokhba's revolutionary gang, these two brothers from Kfar Charuba. They said, the point is that we must take Hadrian's crowns and set it upon our head. Again, the Gemara is picking up on something that we historically know, which is that Bar Kokhba was not merely intending to push out Rome, but he was in fact intending to what? To build a Jewish monarchy. They heard that the Romans were coming toward them. When they set out against them, an old man met them and said, May the Creator be with you, help against them. They responded, let him neither help nor hinder us. The sins immediately caused them to be slain. So what do we have here? Number one is we have a good deal of information about the way the people related to the revolution, the Amcha, as it were. The people, again, who a good portion of the people were not living in the eye of the storm. They weren't living in the Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria area. They were living farther north, either to the coast in the Yavne area or up even farther north in the Galilee. As Bar Kokhba sees more and more success, he's going to try to expand his revolt all the way north, again, in order to take control of biblical Israel. But what we see here also is a criticism of Bar Kokhba, or of his troops. We're going to see this again. That what? That Bar Kokhba, for all his intentions and his goals, what was he looking to do? He was looking to be successful for his own personal reasons and wasn't counting enough of God, on God. So the problem with this is not a contemporaneous source. This is a source that is written later on, which means that we could have an alternative interpretation of this source in the Medrash Rabbah Eicha. What would the alternative interpretation be? That they're writing it after he lost. And after he lost, you have the theological issue, which is, if none other than Rabbi Akiva, the greatest of all the Chachamim, was supporting Bar Kokhba, and it seemed like he had these miraculous victories, why did we ultimately lose? So you got to find some sort of theological explanation for it. So what's the theological explanation? The logical explanation is that you didn't properly count on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? What made the Maccabees successful and Bar Kokhba unsuccessful? The Maccabees, they believed in God, they counted on God, they knew that Hashem was fighting for them, and Bar Kokhba was Koichi V'yotzem Yadi, he was the strength of my hand, of my own right arm, that was what was going to win it for me. Again, the reference to him as Bar Kokhba is interesting. We're going to get to that a little bit later as to why he was called Bar Kokhba, but his real name was Bar Koziba, which the Talmud is going to take as interesting later on. Koziba, kizavon, or achzava, shall we say, means disappointment. But his name was actually Bar Koziba, or probably something like that. So again, we go to the Gemara in Yerushalmi, Tanis, Perek Dei, Abdalit Halacha Hei. It says, Ben Koziba was there. He had 200,000 troops who had cut off their little fingers. So one of the lore that went along with Bar Kokhba's army was that he had very, very high standards for who he would allow in his army. He only wanted the bravest people who were willing to sacrifice everything for the sake of the greater good. So one of the rumored responsibilities was that any member of Bar Kokhba's army had to cut off his pinky. Right? You figure, in order to be a good swordsman or marksman, you don't really need your pinky. But it will show me that you have a good deal of faith and ability and willingness to sacrifice yourself. So obviously the Chachamim were not happy with this. They weren't happy with this for a number of reasons. Most prominently, it's against halacha. Right? One is permitted for maiming oneself, let alone maiming someone else. The sages sent word to him, how long are you going to turn Israel into a maimed people? He said to them, how otherwise is it possible to test them? He says, listen, I'm fighting Rome here. I'm not fighting some cheap, hired army. We're fighting the best army in all of the world. So they replied to him, anyone who can uproot a cedar of Lebanon while riding on a horse will not be registered in your army. So there were 200,000 who were qualified in one way, and the other 200,000 were qualified in another way. Basically, I had two sets of troops. The first group had to cut off their pinky, and I'm sure they regretted not waiting a little while to enlist, because the second group, all they had to do was uproot a cedar tree while riding on their horse. All right, fine. The point was is Bar Kokhba had a very, very high standard for who it would be in his army. Just kind of as an indication that Rabbi Akiva was a supporter, perhaps an inspiration to this, and it's unclear how much of an inspiration Rabbi Akiva was, but he's definitely a supporter.
Is the Mishnah in Sota, Perichat Mishnah Hay, which talks about who would be permitted or not be permitted to go to war. So there was a Kohen Mashuach Melchama. One of the responsibilities or one of the jobs you could get if you were a Kohen was the one who gave the troops kind of the big speech before they went off the war. And one of the things that he would say was, the people who should go home and shouldn't fight with us. Okay, and one of the people who says, anyone who is Yarei V'racha Levav, anyone who is fearful and has a weak heart or a heart that is easily melting, so he should go home right now. So the Mishnah in Sota, Perichet Mishnah Hay, says as follows. The Yasua Shotrim L'daber La'am. So the Shotrim, the leaders or the officers would speak to the nation. V'amru mi aisha yarei, who is the man that is fearful, v'racha levav, and who is of weak heart, yelech v'yashov el beito, he should go back and he should return to his house. So what does this mean? So says the Halakha Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva omer hayarei v'racha levav k'mashma'o. Right? What does it mean? Yarei and rach levav. It's actually its real meaning. What does that mean? She'eino yachov amo b'kishrei milchamav, derot chayar shlufa. A person who is unable to stand up before the horrors of war and an unsheathed sword. Rabbi Yossi Aglili Omer, Yarei v'lach rach levav zeo mit yarei min haveros shebiado. He says, no, listen, everyone's afraid when they go to war. What's it talking about? It's talking about someone who is fearful because he's done averos, he's done sins, and he's afraid, right? He's afraid that he might die because of his averos. So it's just kind of an interesting statement there. You know, Rabbi Akiva's halachic position, was it the inspiration for Bar Kokhba having such high standards for his troops if they were permitted to go to war or not? It says, moreover, that when he went to battle, we get back here to the Talmud Yerushalmi Perek Dalet, in Tainis Perek Dalet Halacha Hei. When he went forth to battle, he was wont to say, Master of the universe, Ribono Shel Olam, do not help and do not hinder, have you not, O Lord, forsaken us, and will not go out with your armies. So, again, here you see this was similar to the Midrash Eicha, which was talking about the two brothers from Kfar Choruba, but here it's talking about Bar Kokhba himself, who when he would go out to war, basically said to Hashem, stay out of this, we can handle this ourselves. You sense here a bit of a bitterness also. He says, you know, you already forsaken us, right? The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed 70 years ago. Which again, the 70 years, or the almost 70 years, shouldn't be discounted, right? The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in the year 70 CE, and now you're here around the year 130, 130, 132. And what's going on? The people are itching because the last exile was 70 years. Maybe this exile is also 70 years. Maybe we should start looking to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. So again, that might have kind of contributed as well to the redemptive spirit that was overtaking the people. What was the rabbinic response to Bar Kokhba? We see here, again, that he seems to be a little bit wild, a little bit crazy, as one would have to be if one was going to take on the Roman army. He seems to have less faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let's say, than they would like. So what was their response? So we remember we had a nice group of Talmidei Chachamim only a few years ago. Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, etc., etc., etc. And if we go back to that Gemara, if we remember the famous discussion over who would be the leader of the Jewish people, or who would be the leader after Rabbi Gamliel was deposed, who was clearly the first choice? The first choice was clearly Rabbi Akiva. But they couldn't choose Rabbi Akiva because, listen, Rabbi Akiva is a descendant of converts, and Rabbi Gamliel might curse him, since Rabbi Gamliel is descendant of Hillel, and he's descendant of David HaMelech. We're all in trouble. So they appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah instead. But in the end of the day, who was the 800-pound gorilla in the room? The 800-pound gorilla in the room was unquestionably Rabbi Akiva. And since the 800-pound gorilla in the room is unquestionably Rabbi Akiva, if he takes a position something, after the Rabbi Gamliels and Rabbi Yoshuas of the world are gone and have passed away from this world, so who's going to argue with him? So even though there might have been some amongst the Talmidei Chachamim who were less than enthusiastic and less than ecstatic about Bar Kokhba as the leader and about this revolt and whether it was a good idea, on the other hand, you have Rabbi Akiva as this main promoter. Rabbi Akiva, who's established a reputation for himself as this leading educator, as the biggest Talmid Chacham, as the spokesman for the Jewish people, as someone who is an inspiration to all, we can only imagine others feeling a bit, let's say, less than bold in terms of standing up to Rabbi Akiva. The person who it could have been was Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, right? Rabban Gamliel, the second son. But as we already saw, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel was one of the first massacres in the early wave of the Roman incursions. After the revolt, the Trajan revolt, he was one of the early massacres. He was one of the early ones killed. So he's not there to stand up to him, nor would I say he could have. For all his lineage, by the time he's stepping in onto the scene, already Rabbi Akiva's reputation is legendary. You know, they don't tell these type of stories about anyone. And just to speak of Rabbi Akiva's power and his force and his personality, you just have to see who his students were. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rabbi Meir. You know, we're talking about the next generation of leaders of the Jewish people. So if you go on in the Yerushalmi and Tainis, so it tells a story, or quoted by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who he said was one of the close Talmid students of Rabbi Akiva. He says, Akiva Rabbi Haya Doresh, Darach Kochav Miyakov. It says in Bamidbar Chaf Dalid that a star, right, that one of Bilam's prophecies is that a star will trample out or walk out from Jacob. So how would Rabbi Akiva read that? Darach Kozba Miyakov. He would say, change Kochba to Kozba. Why would he do that? Because he felt that Bar Kochba was the Mashiach. That was Rabbi Akiva's...
Kozba to Kochba.
Kozba to Kochba, I'm sorry, yes. Which Chazal then changed it to Koziba, right? Which is, again, we said, disappointment later on. But Rabbi Akiva is promoting Bar Kochba as the Messiah, as the one who will lead the Jewish people out of their current exile. The response here is interesting. It says here, Rabbi Akiva kadhava chame bar kozba. When Rabbi Akiva would see bar kozba, he would say, "Hava amar dein hu malka mashicha." He says, "This is the King Messiah." So amar lei Rabbi Yochanan ben Torta. So says Rabbi Yochanan ben Torta, who we know almost nothing about, and he seems to be a very minor character, minor individual in halachic history. But he says to Rabbi Akiva, Akiva, alu asavim b'lechayecha v'adayim ben David lo yavo. So he says, Akiva, grass will grow from your face before the Messiah has come. So you see here, there were doubts as to whether Rabbi Bar Kochba was really the Messiah, but nevertheless, Rabbi Akiva was calling him such. Where it comes up again is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Tzadi Gimel Amud Beis, where again, here you have Chazal calling him not Bar Kochba, but Ben Koziba. He ruled for 2.5 years. And these were the first 2.5 extraordinarily successful years that he had until Hadrian basically brought in all of the troops. So what happens after 2.5 years? So A, Hadrian wasn't around. They chose the time to rebel during a period of time when Hadrian was off doing his other things, when all they had to deal with was the stationed garrison in the land of Israel. But Hadrian finally comes in. For all indications from Dio Cassius and from contemporaneous Roman sources, the Jewish fighters were uncommonly valiant, or crazy, however you might want to say it. They were almost unstoppable, to the point where we said how when Hadrian finally does squash the revolt, he sends back to Rome that the revolt has been squashed, and conspicuously absent is the normative statement of me and my troops are well. There were massive, massive massacres of Roman soldiers, and the Jews were very, very successful in this revolt. And for 2.5 years, Bar Kochba was ruling the first Jewish commonwealth since the destruction of the temple, and probably the last one since the founding of the State of Israel. Or until the founding of the State of Israel, I should say. So it says here, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Ben Koziba ruled for 2.5 years, and he said to the sages, I am the Messiah. So here it's a little bit of a different perspective. The Yerushalmi has Rabbi Akiva declaring Bar Kokhba to be the Messiah, but it seems like Bar Kokhba had his own aspirations. And he says, I am the Messiah. They said to him, in the case of the Messiah, it is written that he senses the smell of the man and he judges. Right? At the beginning of Yeshayahu, when he discusses V'yatza Choter Migeza Yishai, right, that a branch or a root will sprout from Jesse. So it says one of the things he could do is he can judge with his breath, you know, with his smell. Let us see if you can smell if you can send the smell of a man and judge. When they saw that he could not sense the smell of a man and judge, they killed him. So again, how Bar Kokhba dies, that's a whole story in and of itself. But for now, we'll just say, again, Bar Kokhba seems to have aspirations, or he might believe of himself that he is the Messiah and someone who's going to bring redemption to Israel. And again, you're just getting the sense of optimism and hope that existed in these first 2.5 years of the revolt, before the Roman garrisons come. It's interesting, who does Hadrian send? He brings up a general by the name of Julius Severus, who had been successful in squashing the revolts in Britain. So Julius Severus came up, and I don't know if he was speaking English or not, but he came up from Europe all the way to squash the revolt, and you can imagine moving an army that large and getting him there in order to squash the revolt was an interesting occurrence, and it took him a little while, which probably what gave Bar Kokhba his time to be able to be as successful as he was. And again, his goal was to expand beyond Judea and Samaria. This was ultimately unsuccessful, again, because what gave him the advantage in the Judean hills was the fact that they were Judean hills, that he knew them better than anyone else, that he was able to drag the Romans into a guerrilla war, one which they were not used to fighting, and that's how he was able to win. And which is why, you know, all over Israel, they, you know, in every little place, in every little nook and cranny, they're uncovering another Bar Kokhba cave. Why are they uncovering another Bar Kokhba cave? Because that's the way he fought. He fought out of caves, right? The caves were his friends. The caves in the side of the mountain gave you can't see them when you're coming, you know, and it gives you perfect sight of, you can see, you know, 100 troops coming from kilometers away when you're in the land of Israel. But again, there's a sense that there's a tension over this messianic feeling. Rabbi Akiva is a big promoter of it, while some of the sages seem to be less than enthusiastic about it. It's interesting, the Rambam picks up on this, and I wanted to bring this just as kind of a halachic point. The Rambam in his Mishnah Torah, in his Laws of Melachim, Perek Yud Aleph Halacha Gimel, talks about the dangers of messianism for the people. And he talks about the very, very clear indicators of what is or is not, or who is not the Messiah and how one chooses him. Because again, in Maimonidean times, there was also, again, a large messianic movement, an attempt to claim that the Messiah was coming, especially considering all the various decrees, etc., that were going on. Many people were counting up, you know, when the Messiah will come. Even the Rambam does it in his Igaret Yaman, tries to make a claim of when the Messiah will come. So the Rambam in his Mishnah Torah, Hilchot Melachim Perek Yud Aleph Halacha Gimel, says it as follows. One shouldn't think that the Messiah who comes will be someone who performs signs and miracles and produces new things in this world, or he brings the dead back to life, and those similar things. Things just don't happen that way. Why? Shari Rabbi Akiva, Chacham Gado Mechachmei HaMishnah Haya. Right, Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest greatest sages of the Mishnah. V'hu haya nosei kelav shel ben Koziba hamelech, and he would carry the vessels of ben Koziba, thinking that he was the Messiah. V'hayu omer lav shu melech hamashiach. Right, and they thought he was the King Messiah. V'dimahu v'chol chachmei rodoro shu melech hamashiach. Here the Rambam makes a statement which we've already seen is factually incorrect. It's not his fault. He just didn't have all the archaeological information that we have. But he believed that all of the sages of that generation believed that the king, that he was the king Messiah. Achine erag be'avonos, until ultimately he was killed through his sins. So what does he prove from that? He says, A, the fact that they thought Ben Koziba was the Messiah proves Ben Koziba wasn't doing any miracles. He was winning wars. He didn't have to do any miracles. He didn't have to, do any magic tricks or signs or anything. They believed that he was the Messiah. Nevertheless, they were also wrong. So you got to be careful in that sense. Kivancha ne'arag nodalehem sheino. Once he was killed, they saw that he was not, in fact, the king Messiah. V'lo shalumi menu chachamim lo'os v'lo malfeis. Right, but the rabbis, they never asked for any sign or for any miracle for him to perform. That's not what the Messiah does. The Messiah is not a miracle worker, nor should you expect him to do miracles. V'ikar dvarim kachahein, and this is the basis of all of it. Shatorah zos lukeu mishvatel lo'olam lo'olam me'omim, v'in mosim panalem ve'logarei mehem. Right, we don't add or we don't subtract from the Torah. This is what the Torah says, and this is who the King Messiah is. So what's our halachic lesson that we can learn from it? And again, it's something we're thinking about. I think a lot of times the perspective has become that when the Messiah comes, there will be some sort of miraculous event. You know, a gigantic eagle as big as the 747 will land, in the middle of Long Island, and we'll all hop on his back and he'll fly us all to the land of Israel. It may not look like that. It may look like some very, very special person who has a lot of abilities and great faith and religious commitment who inspires large segments of the Jewish people towards a fulfillment of the messianic dream. That might be what happens first. Hopefully he'll be someone of better standards and higher quality than Bar Kokhba, who, again, there was potential there. Certainly, none of us are smarter than Rabbi Akiva, I don't think. And if he could be fooled or taken in by Bar Kokhba, just imagine how easy it would be for us to be taken in as well from those types of experiences. But ultimately, what we see here, just to go over some of the historical points that we've seen before we break until next week. So, point number one is that the brilliance of the strategy of attacking the Romans when they were least expecting it, bringing them into a guerrilla war. We saw the ambivalence of the rabbis to Bar Kokhba, which was ultimately overshadowed by the figure of Rabbi Akiva, who was supporting him. And we also saw potentially what was the chink in the armor or the ultimate flaw in Bar Kokhba, which was his failure to have enough faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So much so did he have faith in his own army and his own abilities that he did not push on without it. But that being said, because he was putting all that faith in his armies, he did fight valiantly. What we know is that for all his craziness and having very high standards for who he would or would not allow in his army, ultimately that paid off in an ability to hold off the Roman army, the Roman Empire, for much longer than any other attempted revolt lasted. We'll stop here, and next time we'll do the issue, Bar Kokhba Part 2, which is kind of the back end of the war where they lose. And it becomes one of the greatest massacres in the history of the Jewish people, hundreds of thousands. And again, when we use that number, considering the Holocaust, it automatically seems kind of cheap. 100,000, the Germans, had the machines that could kill 100,000 in a day. So granted, that is true, but we are talking about one of the worst massacres in Jewish history. So we have that to do, and then we have the aftermath and the what happens to Rabbi Akiva, which is also very, very interesting. Just in terms of his last days, and which may have been his most influential, but believe it or not, considering how much he'd done already. But we'll do that next time. Questions? Yes, Sam.
Did Rabbi Akiva reconsider when things began to go?
I mean, once Bar Kokhba dies, it's fairly clear to him that there's no need to reconsider. He was wrong. Yeah.
Is Lag BaOmer, is that part of the celebrated Bar Kokhba?
No.
No.
We'll get to Lag BaOmer.
Yeah.
Get there.